faith works. It works when your wealth is found in Christ, not your wallet. When you know your treasure is in heaven, that's when faith works. It works when you persevere in the midst of suffering. When you keep on moving, even though you feel like giving up, that's when faith works. It works when your wealth is a conduit of God's blessing. It works when you remain patient, no matter the circumstance. It works when you stand firm in who God is. This is the message of James.
When my brother graduated from veterinary college about 10 years ago, he began to look for a job across the country at a vet clinic. He had recently got engaged to his fiancée, who was living in North Carolina, so he started to look for a job close to where she lived, and eventually he found a job at a clinic. It wasn't the best job he could find, but it was a job that would pay the bills. But the longer that he was working there, the more and more he began to realize that he had got himself into a very toxic work environment. His boss was a jerk. He didn't really care for his coworkers or care for my brother, care for his patients. He was really only out to make a buck, out to make money. And the longer my brother was working there, the more and more he began to realize that he was actually being shorted thousands of dollars from his paycheck. And so he was very frustrated about that, and he began to document what the company owed him. And eventually he sat down with his boss, sat down with the accountant to talk with him about the discrepancy. And instead of them being apologetic, instead of them, you know, making sure to pay my brother back right away, they were frustrated with my brother. They got angry at my brother. They were very reluctant to pay him. Now, can you imagine being in that situation? You're owed thousands of dollars by your employer, and instead they get angry at you. You know, we all face different levels and different forms of mistreatment, some of us more than others. So maybe for you, your boss promised you a promotion, and instead he gave it to his close friend. Or it could be that at school people gossip about you, or they tell lies about you. Perhaps you recently became a follower of Christ, and after becoming a Christian, now your friends and your family don't want to have anything to do with you. Or it could be that people judge you because you're in a mixed-race marriage. Maybe somebody stole from you, and you have no way to get back what was lost. Or maybe your dad left your family. We all face various forms of mistreatment at the hands of others. And the question is, how do we respond when we are mistreated? Are we to fight for justice? Are we to retaliate? Are we to work ourselves into positions of power so we can overthrow those who are corrupt? Are we to seek revenge? How are we to respond? That's the question we're going to tackle today as we look at the last chapter of James. If you're joining us online or over the holidays, or you're joining us from one of our campuses, we're so glad to have you with us today. My name is Jason DeGraff, and I serve on staff as our community group's pastor. We're in week 7 of an 8-week series going through the book of James. It was a letter written by the half-brother of Jesus, and he had gone from disbelief that Jesus was who he claimed to be to seeing Jesus after his resurrection and being one of the first men to die for the belief that not only was Jesus a great teacher, not only was he a great man, but he was God himself who came to give his life for us so we could be restored to a relationship with him. And so James writes this letter, and he writes it to people who are claiming to be Christians, that if you claim to be a Christian, there should be a difference in your life. That Christianity, it's more than a list of ideas to believe, but it's a faith to be lived out. It's a faith that actually works. And so as we get into this last chapter of the book of James, James is addressing a question that his audience would have been asking, and it's this: how do we respond when we are mistreated? So today we're going to be in James chapter 5. If you're using one of our Bibles from Northridge, it's on page 979, and James is answering the question, how do we respond when we are oppressed, when we are taken advantage of, when we are used, and when we are defrauded? And in verses 1 through 6, James sets the scene. He sets the circumstance that his audience was in. He was writing to poor Jewish Christians who were being oppressed by the rich. So look with me at verses 1 through 6 of James chapter 5. He says, "Now listen, you rich people. Weep and wail because of the misery that is coming on you. Your wealth has rotted and moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded. Their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire." Wow, I mean, what in the world is James? He's pretty intense here in this passage. He goes on to say, you have hoarded wealth in the last days. Look, the wages you failed to pay the workers who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. You have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourselves for the day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the innocent one who is not opposing you. Now, that is an intense passage of the Bible. That's an intense passage that James writes there in these first six verses. So what is James so worked up about? What is he talking about here? Well, James is writing a warning to the rich that God's judgment is coming on them because they are taking advantage of the poor. Now, who are the rich people that James was talking about in this passage? Well, we see in verse 4 that they were people who owned fields. They were rich, and they had people who were working for them. So these were wealthy, Jewish, non-Christian landowners who had land outside of the city of Jerusalem, and they're really only concerned with how much profit they could make from their land. And what was it that they were doing that was incurring God's judgment on them? Well, there was three things. The rich were, first of all, hoarding their wealth. We see in verses 3-5 that they were living in luxury and self-indulgence. They weren't using their extra, their wealth, to help those who were in need. We see, number two, that they were failing to pay their workers. So in verse 4, we see that their workers who were harvesting their land, they weren't paying them. Now, these people, they would have depended on their daily or their weekly paycheck just to make it, just to survive, to put food on their table, to put clothes on their back, to care for their families, but they weren't being paid. And number three, we see that they were taking from the poor. So not only were they failing to be generous, and not only were they failing to pay their workers, but they were actually taking from the poor the very little that they had. In fact, in verse 6, James uses the word condemned, which is a judicial term. And what was happening was that the rich were taking the poor to court. They were twisting the legal system to take from the poor the very little that they had, to profit off of them. So the poor were losing their land, they were losing their jobs, they were losing their reputation, and actually some of them were actually losing their lives because they didn't have the means to support themselves. So James is writing in these first six verses a warning to the rich that because of their sinful self-indulgence at the expense of the poor, that God's judgment was going to come on them. And this is the situation of the Jewish Christians that James is writing to. They had no power to overthrow those who were oppressing them, the rich. They were losing their lands, they were losing their jobs, they were losing their means to support themselves. They were stuck in this cycle of poverty under the rich. They were facing severe mistreatment by those in positions of power and authority over them. So the question is, you know, how are we to respond to mistreatment? What did James tell these Christians? Well, before we look at his response, I think it would be good for us to think about some of the ways that maybe we face mistreatment in our life. Now, the average middle-class American is not facing the same forms of mistreatment that James' audience was. And many of us, we face minor forms of mistreatment. So maybe your kid plays a sport, and their coach, you know, has a favorite on the team, and it's not your kid, so your kid is not getting the playing time that he deserves. Or maybe your friends, they've formed a clique, and they've begun to exclude you. Or maybe your teacher at school doesn't really like you, and so she's failed you or given you a bad grade, and now it's going to be difficult for you to get into that college you were hoping to get into. Or maybe the forms of mistreatment that you have experienced have been a bit more severe. So maybe your boyfriend has spent all of his money, all of your money on his drug habit, and now that you're out of money, he's bailed. He's left the scene. Or it could be that your siblings, they've taken more than their fair share of your family inheritance. Or that you were fired from your job, and you were never given a reason why, and now your reputation is ruined. Your resume is ruined. Or that your ex refuses to pay child support, or that your spouse again and again betrays your confidence, betrays your trust. These are all ways that we can relate to mistreatment that many of us have gone to. But then there are forms of mistreatment and injustice that very few of us can even comprehend. So right now, all over the world, in India and Egypt and North Korea, there are men and women who are suffering for their faith. They're being tortured, they're being starved, they're being put into concentration camps and left to die. In fact, even in America, there are kids who are in the foster care system that are aging out of the foster care system. So when they turn 18, many of them are left on the streets to fend for themselves, and many of them end up selling themselves in order to survive. So with all these forms of injustice and oppression, of abuse, of mistreatment, the question is, how are we to respond? How are we to respond when we are mistreated? Now, our society often tells us, you know, don't get mad, but get even. Or why don't you give them a taste of their own medicine? Or people will twist Jesus' words and they'll say, you know, why don't you treat people the way that they're treating you? So this is how society encourages us to respond to mistreatment. But what is James saying? Well, in the next few verses, verses 7 through 11, James gives his answer. But instead of giving us a list of actions to take, James gives us an attitude that we should live out. You see, if we lose with our attitude, then we will also lose with our actions. Now, James recognized that each of us has a different situation. Each situation is complicated, and there's no one list of rules of actions he can give to everybody to live out when we are mistreated. And that's why it's important to be surrounded by a group of wise friends who can help you make the decisions in your life. That's why we would encourage you to be part of a community group at Northridge so you can be surrounded by wise and godly friends to help you make those decisions. But instead of giving us a list of actions, James addresses the attitude we should have when we are mistreated. And he gives us one attitude to reject and one attitude to embrace. So let's first of all take a look at the attitude that James says to reject. So he brings up in verse 9, let's read it together. He says, "Don't grumble against one another, brothers and sisters, or you will be judged. The judge is standing at the door." So how are we to respond to mistreatment? What attitude are we to have? Well, James says, don't grumble. The attitude we are to reject when we are mistreated would be to grumble or fight with other Christians. I think James recognizes that something that's true of us, that when we're mistreated, we often mistreat those around us. We often treat the worst those that we love the most. In fact, one of the things that we say often around here at Northridge is that sinful people tend to respond sinfully when sinned against. So what are some common ways that we mistreat other people when we are mistreated? Well, sometimes we gossip. So if people talk bad about us, we begin to talk bad about even those right around us, maybe people we go to church with. We explode. So maybe your boss yells at you at work and you're tense and you go home and you end up yelling at your spouse or yelling at your kids. We laugh at others. So if people make fun of us to feel better about ourselves, maybe we begin to laugh at other people that we don't like or people that are different than us. And we begin to question motives. So if other people begin to doubt us, then we begin to lose trust in the leaders around us and the people we do life with, maybe the people we do group with. We become selfish. So if somebody takes from us, we hold tightly on to what we have instead of being generous with what we have. Sometimes we withdraw. So if people push us away, they neglect us. Sometimes we do the same thing to the people that we love. When I was going into sixth grade, my family had moved to a new town in our county. We were living in the same area, but I changed school districts. And that was difficult for me as a sixth grader. I was approaching adolescence, and I had had the same group of friends my whole life. I'd been in the same school, known the same people my whole life. And so I remember riding the bus for the first time to go to school as a sixth grader in a new school and playing on the playground and having kids at school make fun of me. And that was difficult for me as a sixth grade boy wanting to be accepted by my peers. But at the same time, we were living in the same area. We still attended the same church. In fact, my dad was the lead pastor of the church we attended. And I began to do the very thing that was happening to me at school. In a comfortable environment for me at church, I began to make fun of other kids at church so I could feel better about myself. And that was the exact thing that James encouraged us not to do in this passage. I was responding to my mistreatment by mistreating other Christians. What James is saying is to don't grumble internally while you suffer externally. Don't grumble internally while you suffer externally. And now he's not saying don't fight systems of injustice or oppression or don't stand up for yourself, but he is saying don't fight with each other. As Christians, we can't let the evil actions of others cause us to fight with each other. So the one attitude that James gives to reject when we are mistreated would be to grumble against other Christians. But how are we to respond? What is our response? What attitude should we have when we are mistreated? Well, James gives his answer in verses 7 and 8 and verses 10 and 11. Look with me at verse 7. He says, "Be patient then, brothers and sisters, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield his valuable crop, patiently waiting for the autumn and spring rains. You too, be patient and stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near." He goes on in verse 10 and says, "Brothers and sisters, as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. As you know, we count as blessed those who have persevered. You have heard of Job's perseverance and have seen what the Lord finally brought about. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy." So what is James' advice to how we are to respond to mistreatment? What is the attitude that we are to take? Well, in short, James says to be patient. But to be honest, I mean, which one of us wants to be patient? I mean, being patient is annoying, being patient is difficult, being patient is frustrating. You know, it seems like the faster and faster our society gets, the easier things become, the more and more difficult it gets for us to be patient. So for an example, the Burger King near my house has two drive-through lanes. You know, so as the fast food's not fast enough, you got to get your Whopper even faster. Or maybe you go to Wegmans, and all you need is a gallon of milk. So you grab your gallon of milk, and you go to the 7-item or less line, and the person in front of you has a full shopping cart. And really, it's not one of the small ones. It's one of the big ones. And you're like, are you serious? Are you kidding me? What's happening here? You want to call security? You want to have this person arrested? I mean, they are slowing you down from getting your gallon of milk. You know, when I was growing up, we'd have conversations around the dinner table that often went unresolved. We'd have a question that would come up. We wouldn't know the answer to the question, and we just have to leave it at that. But today, every important debate can be solved within an instant. So maybe you're debating with your friend, you know, like, who did the voice for Gru in Despicable Me? Well, you can Google it. Or maybe you're wondering, you know, who won the 2011 World Series? Well, you can ask Siri. I mean, that is if Siri actually understands what you say, and then, you know, you lose patience and you move on. You know, we in our culture, we expect our friends and our family or our coworkers to respond to us immediately. So we will send out an email, and if they don't respond within an hour or a day maybe, you know, then we'll eventually give them a call. And if they don't respond to our call, then of course we text them. And if they don't respond to that text within 2 minutes or maybe even 2 seconds, we figure out either they're ignoring us, that they hate us, or that they're dead, right? So we live in a world where it's increasingly difficult to be patient. But God is serious about patience because persevering, glad-hearted faith in God requires it. A faith that actually works requires it. So James says, when people take advantage of you, when you are facing opposition, to be patient. But maybe you're thinking, be patient? Really, Jason, be patient? How in the world can I do that when I just lost my job, when I can't pay my bills, when my business just went under, when my teacher is excluding me from opportunities to get into a good college, when my wife just took my kids and she took my house, when my cousin just stole away the family business? How in the world am I supposed to be patient then? James, in these next few verses, shares with us three reminders that enable patience even when we are mistreated. And the first one is this, that God will bring justice. So in verses 1 through 6, again, James is writing a warning to the rich that God is going to judge them. But why would James be writing this warning to the rich who weren't even Christians? I mean, would they even be reading this letter? Well, the point of James writing this warning to the rich was not primarily for their benefit, although they would do well to heed that. We would all do well to heed that warning. But instead, it's for the encouragement of those who are suffering because of them. James wanted to remind these Christians who didn't have the power to overthrow those oppressors, their oppressors, that God would judge them. Sometimes, although, I think it feels for us like those who are mistreating us are just getting away with their actions. In 1977, there was a 16-year-old girl named Sharon Schulmeier who was brutally raped and murdered, and she was later found by her mom. And for the last 39 years, that case has gone unresolved. This mom has suffered the loss of her daughter. And somewhere out there, this man who was guilty was getting away scot-free as she was suffering the loss of her daughter. And she waited if justice, she wondered if justice would ever come. Until last year in 2016, when DNA evidence was found and the criminal was caught. He was convicted, he admitted to his crime. And after 39 years of waiting for justice, this mom finally saw justice served. For you, it might seem like justice is never going to come, that those who are mistreating you are just going to continue to get away with it. But James reminds us in this passage to be patient, that there is a day when all those who are guilty will face God's final and full and ultimate justice. It might not be this side of heaven, but God will bring justice. Now, the second reminder that James gives in this passage that enables us to endure mistreatment with patience is that our suffering is temporary. So in verses 7 and 8, James moves on from this warning to the rich of God's judgment that's coming on them. And he writes to these Jewish Christians that Jesus is coming, and that when Jesus comes, their suffering will come to an end. In fact, in verse 8, James encourages the believers that not only is Jesus coming, but his return is near. It's coming sooner than they think. What Jesus and the other followers of Jesus, or what James and the other followers of Jesus knew, is that Jesus could return at any moment. It could be that day. It could be in the years ahead in their lifetimes, in their kids' lifetimes. It might be a long time, but they anticipated and looked forward to Jesus' anytime return. And what James is saying in this passage is that the end of your suffering is coming sooner than you think. You know, isn't that how time works? It always goes faster than we think. So we put a date on our calendar. Maybe you're anticipating the end of the semester. Maybe you're looking forward to your summer vacation. Maybe you can't wait to move out of your parents' house, or you've got a wedding and you can't wait till that date arrives, or you're pregnant and you really can't wait to meet your child for the first time, or you're going to retire in a year or two. So you put that date on your calendar, you can't wait for that date to come, and before you know it, that date comes and that date passes. In fact, in September, I stood on the stage and I announced to the church that my wife Laura and I would be having our first child. And as of today, July 2nd, my daughter Eden is now 6 months old. I can't believe it. I mean, the last 10 months have flown by. And it seems like the older I get, the faster and faster life seems to go. In fact, I think my life, and probably many of our lives, could be described as very long days with very fast years. So the days are long, we go to bed tired, and before we know it, we wake up and 10 years have passed. You know, it's the year 2027. James is saying, Jesus' return will be here before you know it, so be patient. But unfortunately, when we suffer, I think often it feels like our suffering is never going to end and like Jesus is never going to come. And my wife, Laura, and I have begun to realize that this is much how our daughter, Eden, feels about eating. So she will be sleeping and have a cute smile on her face and just be so peaceful. And then all of a sudden the hunger pangs kick in and she wakes up with a cry and she's crying like mom is never going to come and like there's no more milk in the world. And what she doesn't realize is that mom is just in the other room. She hears her cry and she's going to be here before we know that her mom is not going to let her to go hungry. And James wants to remind us that when we face suffering, when we are mistreated, when others take advantage of us, when it seems like there's no end in sight, that Jesus will be here before we know it, and that our suffering is temporary. Now, the third reminder that James gives us that enables our patience when we are mistreated is that God blesses those who endure. So James gives us two examples in verse 10 and 11 that we should look to when we are oppressed, when we're overwhelmed, when we feel like giving in. He points out the prophets who spoke for God, and he points out a man named Job. So what's a prophet? A prophet was a man or a woman that God would give a specific message to, and he'd ask them to deliver that to a group of people. And many of the people who received these messages from God suffered because of that message that they brought. These were men like Daniel and Jeremiah and John the Baptist who suffered when they brought this message. So James reminds these Jewish Christians of these heroes of their faith who had suffered for bringing God's message. And then he also reminds them of this man named Job, a rich man. And I think it's interesting he brings up Job because Job is the trump card of suffering. Nobody had suffered like Job had suffered. So unless you've lost all 10 of your children, you've lost all of your wealth, you've been homeless, and you've been stricken with a debilitating disease, then you've probably not suffered like Job has suffered. And though Job and the prophets didn't endure their suffering with perfect grace, they did keep their faith in God, and God blessed them. In fact, God returned to Job twice what he lost in the first place. He had twice the wealth, twice the children, and his health returned. But Job's example is not a guarantee for us that God is going to restore to us all that we've lost in this lifetime. But God gives us a better promise than that. In fact, Jesus says in Matthew 19, 28, and 29, he says, "Truly I tell you, in the renewal of all things, when the Son of Man sits on his glorious throne, you who have followed me will also sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or fields for the sake of my name will receive 100-fold and will inherit eternal life." James reminds us that when we suffer, when we face oppression and mistreatment and rejection from others, what enables us to be patient is to remember those who have endured with patience. When I was in college, I attended a church in Iowa, and we had a man in our church named John Leonard that our church sent to Brazil to be a missionary. So him and his family went there to start churches. They went to a very impoverished area where people were facing prostitution, drug addiction, where there were kids that were being trafficked. And God really began to use him and his family to help people get out of these cycles of poverty and addiction. But by doing that, that impacted the pocketbooks of the drug lords. And so one Sunday after a church service had got out, he just finished preaching. And at the time, all of John's family was back in the United States, visiting family in the States. And he had just finished this service. He just finished preaching. He was greeting people as they left the church. And a man who had been hired by the drug lords came up to John, and he shot him in the face and shot him in the neck 6 times, twice when he was laying on the ground. And after this man left, his friends quickly threw him in the back of a car. They rushed him to the closest medical center where his situation continued to decline. He went into a coma, and the hospitals there in Brazil couldn't help him. Now, can you imagine being his wife or being his kids wondering, you know, am I ever going to see my dad again? Am I ever going to see my husband again? Is he going to make it through this? Well, because they couldn't help him in Brazil, they ended up flying him back to Iowa, to the United States. He went to a hospital there, and he spent another 12 days in the hospital in a coma. And finally, he woke up, and he began to recover. But his life would never be the same. He was paralyzed from the waist down. He had very limited use of his arms. And as he sat there in the hospital with his wife looked at him and said, you know, I guess that's it. I guess we're done. We're not going back to Brazil. And John said, I still have a voice. I can still preach. I still have a passion for the people of Brazil, and I want to go back. And so 2 years later, they moved back to Brazil to continue to serve God there faithfully. And God has used them to start over 21 churches. You know, when I'm tempted to give in, when I'm oppressed, when I face opposition, when I face mistreatment, when I want to retaliate, remembering the story of John is one of the things that helps me to continue on, to endure. And one of the best practices that we can incorporate into our life as a follower of Jesus is to read and reflect and watch and remember those who have gone before us, who have suffered greatly for their faith, but have endured with patience. In fact, one next step I would encourage all of us to take this week would be to read this week's weekly Equip email. If you don't get that email, there's a box at the bottom of your program where you can check that off. We will sign you up for that this week. But in this week's weekly Equip email, it'll be full of resources to movies, to biographies, to books, to sermons about many great men and women of faith who have endured great suffering for their faith, but have endured with patience and endurance. And every time you are mistreated, remind yourself of these stories so that you can endure with patience. As we wrap up today's talk, as we wrap up this passage, I want to leave you with one final statement that summarizes what James is saying in this passage. And it's this, that God's future justice enables our present patience. God's future justice enables our present patience. So when you feel like giving up, when you feel like giving in, when it seems like the guilty are going free, remember that God's future justice enables present patience. God will bring justice. Our suffering is temporary. Jesus will return, and God blesses those who endure with patience. Let's pray. Dear God, I thank you for this letter from James. I thank you for his example of even dying for his faith. And I pray you'd help us to remember those who've gone before us, who have suffered greatly, that we might endure with patience this week, even when we are mistreated. We thank you for your word. We thank you for these people. And may you be honored today. In your name, Jesus Christ, amen.